Welcome to Living Healthy Together. Each week we share patient stories, advice and insights from those closest to care, dive into health-related current events, and explore the local and national issues shaping healthcare across our region. I'm your host, Philip Rao, with the University of Vermont Health.
I will never forget Dr. Gupta walking in my room and saying the results were phenomenal. I don't think it gets better than that. And I feel it in my body, just going up and downstairs, traveling. This summer, I really noticed a difference. I just wasn't compromised the way I used to be.
Dorsey Naylor of Jericho, Vermont, has always embraced all life has to offer, especially anything that gives her an excuse to be active, outside, and challenging herself. But in 2023, the grandmother and dedicated cross-country skier faced an unexpected and life-changing diagnosis, heart valve disease. An echocardiogram discovered that Dorsey's mitral and tricuspid valves, parts of the heart that ensure oxygenated blood flows one way into the heart and deoxygenated blood flows towards the lungs, were leaking, allowing some blood to flow in the wrong direction with each beat of her heart and putting her at risk of life-threatening complications. Historically, conditions like those affecting Dorsey's heart have been difficult for cardiologists to treat. High-risk patients, unable to endure surgery to replace or repair faulty or damaged valves, were left with no options. But rapid advances in minimally invasive treatments, led in part by the interventional cardiology team at University of Vermont Medical Center, have changed the landscape of cardiac care for patients with heart valve disease. This week on Living Healthy Together, we'll sit down with Dorsey to hear more about the impact these leading-edge valvular therapies had on her health, wellness, and quality of life, and speak with some of the interventional cardiologists whose work developing these minimally invasive procedures has helped reshape cardiovascular health and expand treatment options for millions of Americans. Dorsey, thanks for joining us today and sharing your story. How did this medical journey begin for you?
In 2023, I was diagnosed with heart failure following a hospitalization for pneumonia, which came as quite a shock. I'm a real outdoors person. The year before, I had done a wonderful event called the Boulder Tour in Sun Valley, which is a 34K Nordic race. And I mention that only because being physically active really nourishes my body and my spirit, and it's been a big part of my life. Well, with the heart failure, the main symptom for me was just profound tiredness, and I could hardly get out of bed. I had no energy to do anything active, whether it be cross-country skiing, hiking, kayaking, swimming, dance. And this came hard because it came at the beginning of cross-country season. And that is, of all things, my biggest passion in sports.
Was this fatigue, these symptoms of tiredness, what led you to go to the hospital and be diagnosed with pneumonia in the first place?
What happened is on October of 2023, on Halloween Day, I went to see my primary at Richmond Family Medicine for a routine pre-surgical exam because I had a pterygium in my eye and I had to have it removed. And during that exam, my primary found out that I had AFib, which again was a great shock, you know. But I wasn't feeling any of the heart symptoms at that time. But then after the surgery, which was kind of a complicated thing, I had to be absolutely still for a week. And I came from being very active to being absolutely still so I wouldn't disrupt this very fragile eye situation I had. And that's when I came down with pneumonia and was feeling absolutely run over with the truck. And so we went, husband took me to the ER, and it just sort of cascaded forward. I was given antibiotics and I was seen by cardiology, but they weren't aware of all this other thing until I went home for a week. And then I was right back in the hospital. And it was at that point that they started doing more extensive studies, such as the echocardiogram, and found out that I had this severe mitral valve and tricuspid valve leakage, or what they call regurgitation. So then it became the process of how can we treat this? And I saw several different people, and they decided that I was not a candidate for surgery. At that point, I was 81, but that there was this mitra clip procedure that could go in and close or semi-close my mitra valve, and that would make a difference. So I had that procedure done in February of 2024.
The mitral clip procedure is a minimally invasive treatment that places a small device on the mitral valve to reduce leakage. Later in the show, we'll talk with Dr. Tanush Gupta, an interventional cardiologist who, along with interventional cardiologist Dr. Roni Lahoud and a team of nurses and attendings from anesthesia, imaging, and cardiology, performed Dorsey's procedures. Dorsey, what happened to your quality of life between diagnosis in late 2023 and the mitral clip procedure in early 2024? What were you experiencing in your everyday life?
I had a lot of fatigue. I was sleeping a lot. And any time there was a change of grade, i.e. walking upstairs, just walking on a sidewalk that went up, trying to be on a ski slope that went anything but totally flat, I would start having shortness of breath. And so this was a huge change in my lifestyle.
What was it like mentally going through that physical decline?
It was a real reckoning. I have a meditation practice that helped me with that. But, you know, I just couldn't do many of the things which I was used to doing. But then, you know, in those kind of situations, even though I wasn't affected by COVID, I think one thing that a lot of us learned was focus on what you can do, not what you can't do. And so that's what I tried to do.
How did the mitral clip procedure impact your symptoms? Did you go back to being able to do these things that you had been able to do earlier in your life?
It certainly helped. And a few weeks after the procedure, I began cardiac rehab. So I was doing that 3 days a week for 2.5 hours a day for 3 months. And that, on a couple of levels, that really helped. I have never exercised. I've never, ever been a machine person. I've always wanted to get my exercise outdoors. So here I am in this gym. And the first time I'd ever been on the elliptical, the rowing machine. I had been on bike trainers because I do a lot of biking, but the rowing machine and lifting weights, which I'd never done before and everything. But everybody was so encouraging. One day I had been to a dance class before and they saw that I was a little tired and they asked me what was going on. I said, well, I just went to a dance class. Oh, no, you shouldn't be doing anything like that before cardiac rehab. So I didn't. And another day I went in and my blood pressure was too low. And so they really monitored you closely, but it was always with a friendly, helpful, hopeful kind of way. And, you know, 3 months, 3 days a week, you develop this sort of esprit de corps, both with the staff and with the patients there. So I really focus on what you can do. I focus on that. I really got to really like cardiac rehab because I could see I was slowly getting better. I was slowly having more energy and more stamina. So that spring, I had the good fortune of going on a hiking trip in Cinque Terre in Italy. And there's quite a lot of up and downs. And it certainly was not the way I'd been able to hike before, but I was able to do it in a way that respected my body, that I would stop when I got a little tired and everything. So it was good. But then towards the fall, and particularly in November, I felt that I plateaued and I was sort of stuck or going backwards. And then they recommended the tricuspid procedure.
This is another leading edge, minimally invasive procedure that's used to replace faulty tricuspid valves called transcatheter tricuspid valve replacement.
The cuspid procedure just got FDA approval in November. And then I had it in January. So I was just so profoundly grateful that, one, they had such a procedure in terms of modern technology, and that I could get it 20 minutes from my house in Jericho at UVM Medical Center. And Dr. Gupta and his partner had the skills to do this. I mean, this was cutting edge stuff. So it was just profound gratitude. And then I went through another 3 months of cardiac rehab. And then I was able to go on a bike trip. I have to admit, it was the first bike trip I'd done on an e-bike. But what I learned was you still get a lot of exercise on an e-bike. So I came home immediately and bought an e-bike. And that's what I call the adaptations. I cannot ride my road bike the way I used to up the hills and everything. But I can. And so that's given me the joy back that way. And it's been after the second procedure. And I've got to say, I will never forget Dr. Gupta walking in my room and saying the results were phenomenal. I don't think it gets better than that. And I feel it in my body because I can now, I mean, I'm never going to do that Boulder Tour 34K again, but heck, I've already been up to Craftsbury a couple of times and can really feel my kicking and gliding and hiking with friends here and just going up and downstairs, traveling. This summer, I really noticed the difference just going up and down through all the airports and everything you have to do. I just wasn't compromised the way I used to be. I still need a lot of sleep, more sleep than I used to. But I listen to my body and say, it's okay.
You've mentioned adaptation a couple times, and it seems like you've really leaned into finding your new normal and how to make changes that allow you to continue doing the things you love.
I feel I have been given a new lease on life. Now, can I do everything? No, but the other factor is now I'm 83, you know, I can be really reasonably active again and do most of the things and along making, you know, some adaptations like the e-bike or I now my extremities when I'm out in the cold get colder. So I now have heated mittens with batteries in them and I use toe warmers and everything. They make it work. You know, you have two choices. You either lean into it or you fight it. And that's negative energy. I believe in positive energy. And as I said, focus on what you can do, not what isn't possible. And there's a lot in this world that I can do and that others can do.
It's time for a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll sit down with interventional cardiologist Dr. Harold Dowerman, the system director for interventional cardiology across UVM Health, to talk about valve disease, advances in interventional cardiology, and the public and individual implications of advances in treatment and therapy for valve-related conditions of the heart. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're digging into the innovations that have expanded treatment and cardiac health options for millions of Americans suffering from heart valve disease. We're joined now by Dr. Harold Dowerman, an interventional cardiologist and system director for interventional cardiology across UVM Health. Dr. Dowerman, thanks for joining us and sharing your insight. Orient us a bit here. We know that there's been a surge in innovation and that those innovations have created really impactful changes for high-risk patients dealing with heart valve disease. When did this surge in innovation begin, and what's made these rapid advances possible?
We positioned ourselves to grow through innovation using clinical trial research, primarily industry funded. This started in the 2000s with coronary interventions, where we worked with novel drug-eluting stent designs, brachytherapy, radiation treatments, and other treatments for coronary artery disease and acute myocardial infarction. In 2011, a new clinical trial field opened up, which was in aortic stenosis, to treat blocked aortic valves with transcatheter percutaneous techniques that are minimally invasive. This led to the launch in February of 2012 of our first clinical trial patients treated with the TAVR devices as part of a clinical trial. TAVR stands for transcatheter aortic valve replacement. And since that moment, we've done at least 5 different clinical trials of TAVR in different patient populations and using different TAVR devices that have been developed. We continue to do research into the TAVR area. Some of these patients we treated back in 2012 to 15 are now coming back with failure of their valves And we're studying how best to treat them through a study called RESTORE, which is also industry funded, to look at other minimally invasive options for these patients who are coming back 10 to 15 years after their initial therapy. In parallel to this, the other valves of the heart started to become amenable to percutaneous treatment options and were also examined using a clinical trial basis. For example, in 2016, we started a program to treat leaky mitral valves using a device called the MitraClip that had been studied in two prior clinical trials. We're now doing the equivalent of TAVR for the mitral valve. And for example, next week, we will place a replacement valve in the mitral position as part of a clinical trial called the Apollo trial that will be a complete replacement, kind of like the TAVR valve is in the aortic position. We're hoping that there's FDA approval and all these programs, which start as clinical trials, become routine clinical options for patients in our community. As we look to the future, there will be four clinical trials looking at new valves in the tricuspid valve space beginning in this year. And we hope to be part of two of those clinical trials. We're currently using two FDA-approved devices to treat the tricuspid valves that are leaky, but this area is going to evolve rapidly, and us being part of clinical trial research is critical to us getting the best technologies to the patients in our community.
So many advances have already taken place, with more to come. How many and what types of patients have had their treatment options expanded by these innovations?
Valvular heart disease affects millions of patients. Exactly how many million depends on whether you're looking at severe valvular heart disease or moderate valvular heart disease or mild. But patients will develop valvular heart disease, and the typical symptoms will include shortness of breath, fatigue, and possibly chest pain. There is some overlap between the symptoms of valvular heart disease and the most common diagnosis related to heart disease, which is coronary artery disease. Coronary arteries are not valves, they're pipes. Your heart needs pipes that supply blood to it, and there are three pipes. These get built up with plaque due to high cholesterol, smoking, diabetes, or bad genetics. And we treated those and have been treating those with coronary stents plus medications since 1993. So often people confuse the idea of, hey, if you don't fix my heart, my valvular heart disease, will I have a heart attack or stroke? And the answer is no and no. This is unrelated. Heart attacks come from blockages of the coronary arteries, the pipes. Strokes come from a variety of causes, but involve clots going to the brain or blockages of the brain arteries. Valvular heart disease is its own set of symptoms. Unfortunately, valvular heart disease, just like coronary artery disease and stroke, can be fatal. Untreated blockages of the aortic valve will lead to heart failure. And the heart will stop pumping adequate blood to supply the body with oxygen, and the patient will die. So it's important for us to be referred and monitor these patients with valvular heart disease before they develop an end-stage form with heart failure. And that's true for disease in the aortic valve, mitral valve, and tricuspid valve.
What do we know about the millions of people affected by heart valve disease? Are these mostly older people, or are they spread more evenly across demographic groups?
We've done a lot of research into this in the aortic stenosis space, and some of the research we've found is probably true across the mitral and tricuspid space as well. In the United States, the use of the TAVR valve was first launched in patients who were elderly and very sick. The average patient was 82, had multiple reasons surgery was not a good option for them. That has changed dramatically since 2012. We're now 50% of patients who are 65 and under with aortic valve disease get TAVR, and 50% will get surgery for if the problem is only aortic stenosis. Overall, though, most of these diseases are wear and tear of the valve. So they occur more frequently as you get an older population. So we expect 3% of people over the age of 80 in the United States to develop severe aortic stenosis requiring intervention. So if you do the math and say there are 300 million, Americans. That's millions of people. These patients not are all candidates for any invasive procedure. Some of them may have other comorbid conditions like a cancer or dementia that doesn't warrant intervention on the heart valves. But for those who do, we now have these percutaneous options that are far less invasive than open heart surgery. And because of that, I think that the primary place that we are going to see the most treatment of valvular heart disease with these minimally invasive therapies are older Americans, patients 75 and older. But it is available to a younger group, and we meet with patients, we offer them surgery or the percutaneous minimally invasive options, and we go through the risk-benefit of both, and cardiac surgeons have similar conversations with them, and we engage the patient in deciding on what the best next step is.
These paradigm-shifting procedures are all minimally invasive in nature and are performed using catheters, thin, flexible tubes that are inserted into a blood vessel, which then guides it to the heart. At Duvia Medical Center, there's a place called the Cardiac Catheterization Lab. What is that space, and how critical has it been in supporting these advances in the treatment of heart valve disease?
Cardiac Catheterization Lab at Duvia Medical Center is unique because it's the only one in the state. We're the only cardiac catheterization lab in the region, including the Adirondack region in New York, to offer these therapies. In some institutions, the procedures are performed both in the operating room and the cardiac catheterization lab. But we made a decision over a decade ago that to allow adequate growth for the volume and meet the community needs, we would rebuild two of our cardiac catheterization labs specifically designed to allow these structural heart procedures, which is a team sport. It requires anesthesiologists. Sometimes it requires non-invasive cardiology experts doing specialized imaging, nursing support, research coordinators, as well as interventional cardiologists and cardiac surgeons working as a team. So yes, the cath labs are the only place that structural heart procedures are performed in the state of Vermont, and only at University of Vermont Medical Center. And it's critical access for patient care in our entire region.
Dorsey mentioned cardiac rehabilitation a couple of times. And just last week, Dr. Sherry Kadanga, director of that center, mentioned that only a fraction of eligible patients actually participate in cardiac rehab. How important is rehabilitation for treatment of heart valve disease?
The treatment of valvular heart disease starts with medical therapy, may progress to either surgery or to a percutaneous intervention like what we do in the cath lab, the TAVR or MitraClip or tricuspid interventions. But after the procedure, these patients still have a need for medical therapy optimization and continuous follow-up. So what happens afterwards is critical to the overall 5-year outcomes of any patient being treated for valvular heart disease. And we have developed a tiered approach. First, we refer all patients to cardiac rehab, and we refer them to the cardiac rehab program closest to wherever they live. So anywhere in our system that offers cardiac rehab, we take advantage of that. And the nice thing is healthcare insurance covers cardiac rehab after invasive cardiac procedures nearly 100% of the time. There are barriers to going to cardiac rehab, and not all patients choose to go. Barriers can include, for example, travel time or the need to work. But we encourage it. It's a very valuable program. It's run incredibly well, and our patients always give us very positive feedback. For patients, even if they do cardiac rehab, we have a follow-up at 30 days with one of our assistants scheduled at either UVM Medical Center's closest location, which is Tilly Drive, or in for our New York patients at CVPH. And this is also critical that we check in with patients at 30 days. Often we do a repeat echocardiogram, see how they're feeling, assess the valve function, and optimize medications. Finally, all of our patients also get referred back to whoever their primary cardiologist or primary care doctor or family practitioner is. We see them as the front line of monitoring any problems that occur with these patients so that we can then get involved again. So the first year, we have a multi-tiered approach to follow-up to make sure patients don't get lost in the system and continue to get the important medical care they need.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll sit down with two interventional cardiologists from UVM Medical Center who are central to the paradigm-shifting advances in treatment for heart valve disease that have expanded treatment options for millions of Americans, and hear how these life-changing procedures came into focus and what's coming next in the world of interventional cardiology. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're exploring advances in interventional cardiology that have expanded treatment options for millions of Americans suffering from heart valve disease. We're joined now by Dr. Tanush Gupta, an interventional cardiologist and associate director of the Cardiac Catheterization Lab at UVM Medical Center. Dr. Gupta, thanks for joining us today. You've worked on clinical trials focused on advancing treatment for heart valve disease since you were a clinician in training, and you've been central to clinical trials and advances in care at UVM Medical Center. Why has finding a way to help patients suffering from heart valve disease been so challenging for so long?
Tricuspid valve most commonly is affected by tricuspid regurgitation, which is leakage of the tricuspid valve. This most often happens due to a secondary or a functional etiology. So there are changes that are happening in the heart that lead to remodeling of the tricuspid valve, and which lead to the tricuspid valve being leaky. So tricuspid valve disease is usually associated with something else. It's things like atrial fibrillation, which is a common heart arrhythmia, left-sided heart disease, be it with reduced or preserved ejection fraction. Patients who have tricuspid regurgitation usually have multiple other comorbidities, and tricuspid valve disease is essentially a byproduct of what's going on in the rest of the heart. So by the time the patients with tricuspid valve disease have clinical symptoms, once the valve disease itself starts to bother them, usually they are older and they have multiple medical problems, and surgery becomes higher risk, and the surgical outcomes have not been that good. And I think that's a part of the reason why this valve has been historically been undertreated.
You've also led or been involved in work pioneering a new treatment for those with mitral valve regurgitation as well, called the MitraClip, which listeners may remember Dorsey mentioning was involved in her treatment. Can you talk about both of these valves in the heart and how these advances came about?
Tricuspid valve is one of the four heart valves. It's on the right side of the heart. So it's the inlet valve. You know, tricuspid valve has historically been forgotten. And so we have seen patients who have tricuspid valve regurgitation for a long time, but the valve historically has been undertreated. To give you context, it's estimated that around 2 million people in the United States have a significant tricuspid regurgitation, but only around 1,500 tricuspid surgeries are performed every year. So not saying that all those 2 million people need treatment, but the condition is prevalent. It has been underdiagnosed and undertreated. And the reasons are many, but that left a large unmet need for transcatheter therapies. And after the innovations that have happened in the structural heart valvular disease space for aortic and mitral disease, the tricuspid valve was the next frontier. And as I was completing my training, aortic and mitral therapies were well established, but tricuspid valve therapies is something I saw being innovated and implemented as I was beginning my career. And so I chose to fly with it, put my interest in this. The first trials of percutaneous therapies and tricuspid valve disease were happening when I was a trainee. And I participated in some of these cases in clinical trials. And so I wanted to carry that experience forward in bringing this clinically to our patients. When I finished training like 5 years ago, I had been to Vermont, having trained in New York City area. I had from sort of a recreational perspective before, hadn't spent a lot of time in the state. But when I came to interview, I was just pleased with the extent and the breadth of what was going on in this division. Despite the size of the state, I think the division of cardiology was doing more than what you would expect. And this was true in the setting of both clinical work and research work. I wanted to be at a place which had research and clinical trials within the space of interventional cardiology. That was something that was very important to me because all the inventions and the advances that happen in this field happen with prospective clinical trials. So I think if you don't have that infrastructure at an institution, it's hard to be at the forefront. And that was one of the reasons I went into this.
Talk about your work during and since completing your training. What are these advances in heart valve treatment and how do they impact patients?
When I was in training, the trials for transcatheter tricuspid valve therapies were ongoing. Now, as of last year, we have two devices that have been approved by US FDA for percutaneous treatment of patients with tricuspid valve disease. One of these devices is called the TriClip device, which essentially is a tricuspid valve repair device. And the second device is called the EVOQUE valve, which is a transcatheter tricuspid valve replacement device. So both the TriClip and the EVOQUE valve finished their studies in 2024, and the US FDA approved these trials in 2025. And so me, along with the rest of our structural heart team, launched these programs clinically in UVM last year. So we started doing TriClip at University of Vermont in October 2024, and we launched our EVOQUE transcatheter valve replacement program in July 2025. We have treated so far successfully over a dozen patients. And when we started doing these therapies, we have seen increased referrals as we have achieved good outcomes with these procedures. These patients have been suffering for a long time. These patients didn't have any treatment options, but now we do have approved therapies to offer them. And we have made a positive impact on patients' lives.
What is the benefit to a patient to having TTVR done or to having a TriClip procedure done? How does their quality of life improve? Does their health and wellness improve?
Patients with severe tricuspid regurgitation are often very symptomatic. These patients have had these conditions for several years. The typical symptoms the patients feel are swelling in their legs, fatigue, shortness of breath with exertion, sometimes abdominal bloating, early satiety, and tricuspid regurgitation can also lead to abnormalities in their liver function and kidney function due to its downstream effects. So both the TriClip procedure and the TTVR procedure aim to reduce the degree of tricuspid regurgitation. And you know what we have seen both in the clinical studies and in our own experience, patients experience dramatic improvements in their quality of life with improvement in their energy, reduction in the edema, and less shortness of breath. And it's remarkable that we have seen patients out at a week after the procedure, and they say, oh gosh, I'm feeling so much better. And I don't remember the last time I felt this much better. So the goal of tricuspid valve regurgitation treatment, be it with the CLIP device or the TTVR device, is to make subjective improvements in patients' quality of life and improvement in their symptoms.
These procedures also reduce risk for patient vis-a-vis more traditional heart surgery, say open heart surgery. What does it mean to reduce risk?
Unlike other valvular heart diseases, for patients with tricuspid regurgitation, open heart surgery for isolated tricuspid valve disease treatment is rarely performed. An average hospital in the US, which has a cardiac surgery program, performs 1 to 2 tricuspid valve surgeries every year. And the reason for that is the benefit of open heart surgery has not really been shown. As I mentioned, these patients are often sick with multiple other problems, and the rates of mortality after surgery have been reported to be as high as 8 to 10%. And due to a combination of factors, this valve was just ignored, and the surgeons were not taking these patients to the operating room for isolated tricuspid valve disease treatment due to a perceived lack of benefit and due to just a high operative mortality. So this transcatheter tricuspid valve therapies have allowed us to treat these patients with like a 1 to 3% mortality risk, a quicker return to their baseline health status, and dramatic improvements in their quality of life.
How do you see these programs growing and expanding and developing? What's next?
I think there's a lot to do in this space. And in addition to be undertreated, I think tricuspid regurgitation has been underdiagnosed. So one of the important advances in this space is going to be increased recognition of the importance of tricuspid regurgitation, so that when patients have symptoms which are suspicious of tricuspid regurgitation, such as leg swelling, fatigue, shortness of breath, we order an ultrasound of the heart called an echocardiogram to see whether they have heart disease and tricuspid regurgitation in general. And if the patients do have tricuspid regurgitation, they should be referred to the structural heart valve clinics for us to evaluate these patients. And the referral to us doesn't mean that these patients are going to get an intervention. We're going to assess whether these patients might benefit from discontinued monitoring, whether they may benefit from medical therapy, should they be referred for surgery, or are they good candidates for some kind of a transcatheter tricuspid valve intervention. And the second important advance, in addition to increased recognition, is going to be improve diagnostic methods and better quantitation. And quantification of tricuspid regurgitation has also been a challenge so far. Historically, we have graded the degree of valve leakage by color dotted assessment of how much the valve is leaking by a visual impression on transthoracic echo. But there is increased focus now on quantitative parameters on heart ultrasounds to see how bad the tricuspid regurgitation is. So improved recognition and improved quantification are some of the important steps to expand recognition of this disease and so that to make sure we are treating the right patients.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll hear from interventional cardiologist Dr. Roni Lahoud, whose work building a new program to treat hypertension with a therapy that's nearly a century old could have huge implications for treatment and management of one of the leading causes of death worldwide. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're exploring innovations in structural cardiology and valvular therapies that have expanded treatment options for millions of people dealing with heart valve disease. We're joined now by Dr. Roni Lahoud, an interventional cardiologist whose work includes building a program at UVM Medical Center that uses renal denervation to treat resistant hypertension, or high blood pressure, one of the leading causes of death worldwide. Dr. Lahoud, thanks for joining us. Let's start with hypertension, or high blood pressure. It's a huge public health concern worldwide, and there's a lot of complexity behind why high blood pressure is so deadly and why it's so hard to treat. What do people need to know?
Hypertension is unfortunately the number one reason for death worldwide. In 2017, it caused 10.4 million deaths worldwide, and that's more than any other cause. Smoking came in at number two, causing 7 million deaths. So hypertension is a big problem worldwide and impacting our communities here in Vermont and Northern New York, where the prevalence for uncontrolled hypertension is about 45%, both nationally and for our population. And uncontrolled despite therapy rates are about 20 to 30%. If you take folks that are truly taking their medications as they should, and they're really being followed very closely, you still have about 10 to 15% of patients who have true resistant hypertension. So that's a lot of people. And the question to ask, we all know that hypertension is bad for you. Why is it so hard to control? So lifestyle and medications remain our go-to treatments for hypertension. But unfortunately, despite the patient's best efforts and our best efforts as medical professionals, the numbers really are still discouraging in how we control hypertension. And that's many different factors. The number one reason probably being difficulty for the patients to be taking their pills every single day, as we prescribe them for the rest of their lives. There was a study that came out a few years back that looked at patients being prescribed once a day medications for blood pressures. And it found that within a year, half of them were not taking the medications daily as they were prescribed. Very sobering findings. And so knowing that hypertension is really bad for you and knowing that despite everyone's best efforts, they're not very well controlled, there is a need for other things that don't rely necessarily on adherence, on being able to take medications every single day to be able to treat blood pressure.
That's shocking data about mortality and the challenges associated with controlling high blood pressure. Why does controlling it matter?
It matters for a very simple reason. If you're able to lower the blood pressure by 5 points only, you lower the risk of having major cardiovascular disease by 10%. If you're able to reduce it by 10 points, you're able to reduce the risk of stroke, heart attack, heart failure by 20%. So every little bit helps. And that's why we add medications one to another in order to achieve those blood pressure reductions, and why we offer the innervation procedures for patients to be able to drop those blood pressures and hopefully avoid heart attacks or strokes in their future.
Managing high blood pressure is care usually provided by primary care and family practice physicians with support from nephrologists who specialize in treating kidney disease and related conditions. You and a multidisciplinary team have leveraged a technique that's nearly a century old but holds significant promise for people whose high blood pressure doesn't respond to conventional medication and lifestyle changes. Tell us about renal denervation.
Renal denervation is an invasive procedure that we perform in the cath lab. It is a one-time procedure. And it targets the connection between the sympathetic nervous system, which is our fight or flight mechanism that we were all born with. When that side of the nervous system is very activated, it causes constriction of those renal arteries and veins and causes the blood pressure to rise as a consequence. So the idea is by severing the connection between the sympathetic nervous system and the kidneys, you can lower the blood pressures. The idea is an old idea. The first time that it was done was in 1931. That was described in the medical literature almost a century ago. And it was a surgical procedure where they were going in and basically just cutting those nerves. And it led to dramatic reductions in blood pressures. But it is a big surgery, big procedure. So the idea of being able to do this with catheters, plastic tubes that we can insert from either the wrist or the groin, is more recent and really started about 20 or so years ago with the first generation of devices showing very mixed results on whether they were effective or not, leading then to a second generation of devices that has been shown to be safe and effective in reducing blood pressures.
So what's another tool for primary care providers and nephrologists to consider when trying to effectively treat and help patients manage high blood pressure? Is it a silver bullet that's appropriate for anyone with resistant hypertension? How is this therapy currently used and who's eligible?
This would be a procedure that would be done in addition to better lifestyles and medication therapy rather than an alternative to them. So it's something that we want to offer for those that have tried the medications and are taking them to the best extent possible, and they are still hypertensive. And the reason why we reserve it for patients with resistant hypertension is because it is an invasive procedure. It does carry some discomfort, and like any invasive procedures, there's a small risk, it's 1% or less of severe complications, but nonetheless, a small risk that we don't want to offer to every single person with hypertension. We do want to select our patients and ideally have patients that are truly resistant in their hypertension. Estimates are about 10 to 15% of folks that have hypertension are truly resistant, that they have really tried every medication and they are trying their best to take it. Now, if you look at national data, looking at how well we're doing controlling hypertension, if you take all hypertensive people, we're able to actually get the target blood pressure, so less than 130 over 80, in less than 25% of patients. So it's very sobering statistics. And hypertension is very prevalent in Vermont. And the fact that we could offer this very advanced therapy in a rural setting where people don't have to travel long hours to Boston or New York is wonderful. And our patients have really appreciated that. We happen to be one of the very early adopters because we were enrolled in a clinical trial assessing the efficacy and the safety of this therapy. So we have very early experience with this, and we actually mentor other centers on the procedure, on how to do it, best practices, and so forth. So it's very nice to be able to offer this in a rural academic hospital such as ours, and hopefully reduce the cardiovascular burden, all the heart attacks and strokes that we see at our hospital, hopefully prevent some of them going forward.
What's the impact for patients of this procedure?
What we see is not curing hypertension, to be very clear. We see about, on average, a 5 to 10 millimeter drop in blood pressure with the therapy. So it is comparable to adding one full dose antihypertensive. But sometimes this is what the patients need to be in the controlled range versus not. And as we saw, Even dropping 5 or 10 points in your blood pressure will give you 10 to 20% reduction in cardiovascular events going forward. So the intent is to lower the blood pressure in a way that doesn't require adherence to a medication for the rest of your life, and doing it for the reason of reducing cardiovascular events. I've seen it really mean a lot to patients to have that reduction in blood pressure. And people react differently to it. Not everyone has a standard response of 5 to 10 point drop. We have some folks that are super responders where they really have dramatic drops in blood pressures. And we have folks that respond very little. And that probably has to do with how much that sympathetic system is an important part of why they have hypertension. Because there are many different reasons to have hypertension. It's a very heterogeneous disease where many different things will lead to that. But to the extent that the sympathetic system is related to it, we could target that and affect it in most cases. And on average, we want to see the effect of one full drug or more.
With the program up and running and UVM Medical Center actually training other folks on how to provide this therapy, what's next for renal denervation at UVM Medical Center? Is it predictable growth in volume, or are there other things that you're working to develop and bring forward related to this therapy?
In 2012, 2013, my partner, Dr. Darman, was involved in the original trials for the original device. And so the story started there. That device really didn't really pan out as much because the blood pressure reductions were not that impressive with the older generation. With the new device coming on about 3 years ago, we joined the trial again, and that showed significant reductions in blood pressures, which have then led to an approval by FDA, and the guidelines changes in Europe and in the US to incorporate renal denervation as one of the therapies to consider for folks with resistant hypertension. And so initially, we were only able to offer renal denervation for people in a clinical trial. That is no longer the case. Now it is available commercially, and we're starting our program for folks from the general population who don't have to enroll in a clinical trial. The way we're conducting our renal denervation here is very typical of how we do things. We're building a multidisciplinary team of internal medicine, family medicine, nephrology, and cardiology. So we have a group of people updating the guidelines for how we treat folks that we see at the UVM system with hypertension. And every patient that we're going to be performing the procedure on will be reviewed by our team. It's very nice being able to offer this procedure in the cath lab for hypertension. It has led to greater cooperation, collaboration with other departments. And that has allowed us to actually create a team and work together. So that has been a really nice development. And this way we can make sure that we can offer the most advanced medications to make sure that patients are really as controlled as possible. And then if that fails, then consider renal denervation. I think this new technology is gonna do many things for our patient population. A, it's gonna allow them to get the procedure closer to their home. It's gonna allow us to build a regional hypertension referral center. And it's gonna allow better relationships between the different members of the medical team that take care of these patients, cardiology, primary care, nephrology. It's gonna allow us to work closer together. And that's gonna reflect really well for the patients who are gonna have their physicians talk more amongst each other and talk more to them about their options. And it's going to allow us opportunities for further growth and allow us to continue being a hub for innovation and for adopting therapies that are more cutting edge for our population. And what I really hope to see is that eventually we would hopefully be able to prevent some heart attacks and some strokes, because, you know, hypertension is a big problem in Vermont, and so are the sequelae of it, which we see too often. I think anything that we can do to work more on the prevention end of things rather than being more reactive would be wonderful.
That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thanks to all our guests for being with us and sharing their stories and insights. If you're out there listening and have a question, comment, or idea for a future episode, email us at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org. Living Healthy Together is also available as a podcast. If you're interested in checking out some of our past episodes, look us up wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and consider giving us that 5-star rating, which really helps a lot. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.